My name is Arno Glitz, and I'm from Brazil. I'm from the Evangelical Church of Lutheran Confession in Brazil. And I offered myself to talk a bit about the structures, the historical, and, well, let's put it this way. Let's try to see at some historical backgrounds for the structures of power in Latin America. And then, a bit later on, we'll try to see a philosophical explanation for such structures of power. And perhaps also try to dive into some theological explanation of the liberation movements in Latin America. Whenever Latin Americans meet, especially people of churches, people of political sciences and so forth, you bet that within half an hour, no, but within 15 minutes you are talking about transnationals. And then you will have to see that transnationals are not alone. They are something connected with a system, with a structure of things. And so I'm trying to today to try to explain what we Latin Americans mean about structures. Power in itself is not a evil. Power comes from God. Whenever we pray, the Lord's Prayer, we at the end we say, because for yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever, isn't it? Power comes from God. Power is what moves mankind. You all know that America, but the first important discovery that Europeans made towards getting gold, getting more powerful in terms of money, was the way to India by Vasco da Gama in 1490. And this was followed by Columbus discovering the Americas in 1492. As a matter of fact, he landed in Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic. Brazil was discovered by the Portuguese. When I speak of Latin America, naturally I will focus more on Brazil because I'm a Brazilian and I know that better the Brazilian situation. Brazil was discovered in 1500 by the Portuguese for a chance, by Pedro Álvares Cabral. He didn't intend to discover Brazil. He wanted to go to the way to the Indies, and he just got west too much and discovered Brazil. And then whenever these countries, our countries, were discovered, a letter of discovery and of dominion was then written on. So Brazil, from the instant it was discovered, due to the then prevailing divine right of the kings, was already owned by the king of Portugal. And the same happened with the king of Spain and the rest of America. In Latin America. The King of Spain owned that. This was something established by the right that then the kings had. But he needed to take possession. So he sent army, and he didn't come. He sent soldiers. And they took possession. And with them came the church. And the church sanctified, the church acted as a sanctifying bystander, having with this eventual prophets, and many times a lot of prophets. But what did the king of Portugal or the king of Spain interest? They interested gold. Gold in terms of money. So in Brazil, they wanted gold. Now they, in order to find this gold, they needed to send people there. But how you send a guy who is living a good life in Lisbon, how you can send a guy to Brazil? Do we give him a big piece of land? Then you say, well, there's a big piece of land there, this is yours. Probably the person would not go, he would send somebody else. And this somebody else will look for gold. He didn't find gold in Brazil, they found gold in Peru. Remember that all Central America, the west coast of Central America is very well developed, inhabited. And the east coast of Central America is wilderness. Why? Because from Peru they took the gold and shipped it to the west coast of Central America, especially Panama and also Nicaragua and El Salvador, and then on mules took it on the other side to the Caribbean, and then on ships to Spain. In Brazil, they didn't find gold, but they found a timber, a wonderful type of wood, which was used for tinctures. And this wood was named Brazil, hence our name. And for you to have an idea of the plundering exploitation that went on, Brazil nowadays, this wood, we have it only in botanical gardens. Well, the army came in. The soldiers came in to take possession in the name of the king. But then also, they were there paid by the landowners, by the oligarchy that was becoming to grow, and to defend them, to defend an established order of dominating classes. There is the beginning of the military dictatorships in Latin America. This has historical roots. And they make revolutions and so forth, always to defend elitists. Never really to defend the people. In Brazil, we are wonderful Indian killers. When Brazil was discovered, we had about 4 million Indians living in Brazil. We are left now with 200 to 250,000 Indians. In Peru, in Bolivia, in Central America, in Mexico especially also, there were large Indian populations, native populations. And these were oppressed by small elites, small Spanish elites, small white elites who had the army to guarantee this order. There is a Brazilian author named Gilberto Freire, and he is the outstanding Brazilian sociologist. And he wrote, how the Portuguese handled, how they did it with Brazil in the beginning. Then he even describes a scene of two Portuguese friends, and one asking the other, what are you doing? Well, I'm going to Brazil. What, you are crazy, going to Brazil? Then he said, oh no, all these beautiful naked Indian women strolling around. You know what, you can, this is wonderful. And they came. And they lived with Indian women, with many of them, plenty of them. And they had many children. But when they were rich, they came, went back to Portugal, lived off their capital, did not do anything else, and left here the children. So we have illiteracy rates. We did have during centuries no care for health of the population. Why? Because you had this Indian population who did not have the European structure. They were left with the children. Now the Portuguese went back, and he was called, then he had money, he married a Portuguese woman, and the same happened with the Spanish part. He married a Portuguese woman, he was then called Fidalgo. Fidalgo comes from shortening of Filho de Algo, son of something. And he lived of interest on his money. Here you have the beginning, the historical beginning of the fact that in our Latin American countries, the tax system is always to tax the person who works. You pay income tax if you work. But if you have income from interest, capital gains, you pay very little income tax. Because this was from the beginning so. People wanted to get gold out, wanted to get money out. And it is money out. Now you understand why many of the Latin American elites have a lot of money in American banks and Swiss banks. It is to get money out of the country. The same, we can say, happened with land. Brazil was initially divided into 12 capitanias, as it's called. And these 12 capitanias, 12 pieces, large land tracts, enormous land tracts. They're the beginning of all the land disputes that we have in Brazil, because they could be established only very correctly at the coast, but in the interior you couldn't establish it correctly. And not only that, those people who received this grant from the king, the same happened in the Spanish part of Latin America, they were, you know, they had money, because of this land they always took 30, 40, 50, 60% of what the land produced or what the gold that was found and so forth. But they stayed in Portugal. They had their managers here. And these managers always took a kickback. So you have historical background for the corruption that goes on, unfortunately, in Latin America. And here you have also why the land-owning part of Latin America, and in Spanish they have a special name to divide the population. If you go to Peru, for instance, they will tell you, or Peru, or Bolivia, or Ecuador, they will tell you, those, these here are the tierratenientes, those who have land. And the rest of the population, no tierratenientes. Tierra no tenientes, they have no land. In order to get agrarian reforms in our countries, it was started to do it fiscally. But then the land-owning part of the country is always against this, and they resist it very strongly. While such a taxing system would, over the years, produce a very fair and just agrarian reform. In Brazil, just for you to have a contrast with the United States, in Brazil the first white woman came to Brazil 95 years after our discovery. You don't have them education. I told you these kids were left there. There's a very good Brazilian author named Viana Mok. He wrote a book named Pioneers and Buccaneers. And he says that the United States was colonized by pioneers, and several parts in the south of Brazil, beginning 1824, were also colonized by pioneers. This means people who came with their families. It is the woman, the wife, who is the stabilizing factor in a country. And these families who came, these people who came with their wives, they then began really to create a new country, a new fatherland, this notion of a new nation, because they came to stay here. Just the opposite of those Portuguese or Spanish adventurers who came only to get money out. Universities. In the United States, the first university, Harvard, was founded 30 years after the pilgrims arrived, if I'm not wrong. In Spanish Latin America, some universities were founded shortly after, some 10, 20, 30 years after discovery. But these all were for elitists. The landed people, the owners later on of the sugar mills and so forth, they thought that they being the owners of the land, the owners of the money, they had the right that their sons could go to school without paying. But in order to be able to come to the university, you have to have all the preparation, which is paid for. And so, this is still an elitist system of education. In Brazil, it is only since 15 years ago that there is a certain democratizing of superior education. But even so, in order to enter university, you have to have an entrance exam. And in order to be prepared for that, you have to go through paid schools. Again, an elitist heritage that we have. I spoke about the church. I think that you remember the conquest of Mexico, that with with Cortes also came the priests, and with the cross, and all this killing and bloodletting, and all this destruction was done in name of Christ, in name of the church. In Brazil it was the same. Which kind of church came to our countries? The Catholic Church. Today's Catholic Church? No, the anti-reform Catholic Church, especially the Jesuits, with a very fanatical position against anything that was not exactly as Rome determined. It was a very backward religion that came to Brazil. You have to consider that this was the Catholic religion of the Inquisition countries. In Central Europe, Inquisition stopped at the end of the 1500s, beginning mid of 1600s. Well, in Spain, and the same is also true for Portugal. In 1816, the Pope prohibited to continue the use of torture by Inquisition. So up till 1816, the Pope said okay to use of torture in Inquisition in Spain. Inquisition in Spain was finished only in 1823, officially. Really, it lasted till 1840, 1850. So we got a very backward kind of religion to start with in Latin America. With masses in Latin, no literacy. Again, the literacy problem. Well, king. Let's see how this thing developed, because the kings, after all, they faded away. And Brazil got independent in 1822, other Latin American countries before, some others later on. Cuba was the last, 1898 from Spain, and 1902 from American troops. This is a very interesting story. But this foreign capital thing continued. We always had foreign capital in Brazil and drawing money out of our countries. If you look at the story of all of our country histories, they always were indebted to European bankers. And this place of the king who draws the money out, who wants gold and nothing else, come the multinational companies in the last 20, 30 years. You here in developed countries, in the first world countries, you have the multinationals in their wonderful outlook, in the sign of life that they are, in the good things that they do, that they can do because they are concentration of capital. They can, as I told, as I said already, they can hire the best brains to work. But we have them on the bad side. They bring to us, usually, the technology that has been already bypassed in the first world. They bring to us used models of things that you don't want any longer. There are many stories of, even in cars, think in France, they had a very bad car, so they dropped it, dumped it all in Brazil and started a car manufacturing there, which later on was bought by Chrysler and now has been bought by Volkswagen. But this is the way that they operate. Now you would say, oh, you Brazilians, or you Latin Americans, you are at default for that. And I think that everybody's right. I'm one who always says, this corruption that started with the army people, with the soldiers who came to begin with, when they had, let's say, 50 kilos of gold to send to Portugal, they actually had 60 or 70 kilos. They would send only 50 to the king. So this corruption is ingrained in the system. And we have an increasing, unfortunately, it is an increasing impunity in all Latin American countries towards such corruption that is now presently going on in government, high government circles, as you know, and through transnationals. Now, we spoke of power. I always was after an explanation, because this is a system. This is something that, as I told you, this is a whole thing that came together. The king, the army, the king means getting gold out, the army meaning maintaining a status quo and defending the dominant classes, and a church that sanctified everything and got its lands and got its power and got its money and got its buildings for closing its eyes. Unfortunately, now in Vancouver, there was presented a paper in the issue group number 6 in which I worked by Ulrich Duchroff. He is a Lutheran theologian working in Geneva. And this is all Bible cited. If you look at what I told you of what came on, that we have powerful elites, and in Brazil, as in all other Latin American countries, the rich are getting richer. The poor are getting poorer, and the middle class is getting each time more, pressed between these two. And year by year, the middle class has less real acquisition power, real income. Discounting inflation, the middle class is getting poorer also. Now, if you look at this whole worldwide thing, you see apartheid in South Africa. You see invasions like in Afghanistan. Will you see countries who want to have be secure? This is a question of security. Why? Because they feel insecure inside. And this all has a common root. We start defining sin as a desire to be as God. This in the book Genesis, it is already defined. And God created man in his image and likeness and said, have dominion over the earth and subdue it. But subdue it means not exploit it. Luther said that the human role was one of a cooperators of God as stewards. Many times in the Bible we are said you're stewards of the Lord. And this is theologically. So till 1500 more or less, this was the idea that predominated. In 1600 and something, the very famous Francis Bacon, English philosopher, he launched an idea. To know is to have power. This already divided then mankind into two parts, those who knew and those who did not know. Usually those who knew then did something that the others would not know. So those who knew had power. And you know that with the revolution that is going on in the media, the revolution that is going on now in all the technologies of information, you know that there is coming the age of a new power, the power of information. There were some very good papers presented in Vancouver about that. To know is to have power. And this was followed by Descartes. Descartes is the one of the very rational thought, the Cartesian thought. And he had an expression which underpinned all his philosophy of life, and which is that humanity is lord and owner of nature. This is completely against what God said here. Mankind is owner, is lord and owner. Lord, he commands, and owner of all nature. This goes completely against Psalm 21:4, which says that to God belongs all the earth and all the inhabitants, all the oikumene belongs to God. But this year, then, you see that the stewardship, which was the prevailing idea till Luther, was substituted by an ownership. And then, as a consequence of this, to know is to have power. And we, mankind, are no longer stewards. We are owners and lords over nature. This then, over the years, formed, contributed to forming the present structures of power that exist. Consequences. First, the unrestricted exploitation of nature. We are the owners of it, the lords of it. We are no longer stewards. The exploitation of nature people. Because the European people thought that nature people, those native, they are not spirit, they are matter, and we can own them. Here you have the roots for colonialism, and here you have the roots for racism. As a consequence of this ownership and lordship, you had the exploitation of manual labor by lords and owners. This is the beginning of the class domination. And this dominating class, always supported by these oligarchies, supported by armed forces in our countries. Another thing came on, discrimination against women. Women were regarded as a being, a human being of nature and a human being of senses, and not a human being to know. You know that till some 50 years ago, I think, men didn't allow women even to go to college. If they knew to write, and do the housekeeping that was just enough for them. Think, to know is to have power. This was for men. And the use of military force, naturally, especially in Latin America. But this power structure is true all over the world, not only in Latin America, only that in Latin America we have it, let's say, at its most exploitive aspect. Because in other countries you always have had your own growth. In Latin America we had exploitation since the beginning of. For instance, United States, the pilgrims came, they came to establish a new country for their own children. So, they explored the country, but whatever they got, they maintained here and kept here and enriched their own country and their own families here. Exploitation is when you get this same out of the country for the king, nowadays foreign capital. The Latin American thought, fortunately, something wonderful happened. All this ecumenical movement, I always think and like to say that this is the spirit of God acting in mankind. I think that God came to a point that he got fed up with all this. And so he influenced people to get together. You see to this, 1948 was founded the World Council of Churches. 1954 was the Second Assembly in Evanston. 61, the 30 New Delhi. 62, up till then, the Roman Catholic Church did not even, well, they ignored it. We were heretics. We were already people in hell. 61, Orthodox churches joined. 62, the Pope, John 23, called Vatican II. And this was an eruption, especially for Latin America, because we are living in a Catholic continent. We can never forget this. Although we have our churches, but our churches are minority churches. All the Protestants in Latin in Brazil compose 6 to 7% of the population. This is nothing. And even Brazil, I think, is one of the countries, perhaps excluding now the newborns in Guatemala, is the Latin American country with the highest percentage of Protestants. So we are a Catholic continent. So it is important always to see the behavior of the Catholic Church. And unfortunately, Vatican II, the liberating forces within the structures of the Roman Catholic Church also had their good thing in Latin America, and a lot of liberation movements started within the church. And these were based upon, again, upon the Bible, and we have to look at it. It is on Genesis 9. And then he said to man, I have given you all the things. And he gave the commands of how this covenant should do. When Noah went into the ark, you remember that God told him, not only you, but you and your sons and all the animals. This means that salvation was not a pietist thing only for me, as we had it during centuries, especially from Europe. This is a heritage of Europe, that we have this thing that I'm pietistic and so forth, my salvation is guaranteed and the rest go to hell. No. The covenant that God made with Noah indicates that salvation was for all mankind and all living creatures. And secondly, God, by asking all the animals to come in, he also gave an ecological command to Noah. So, this is, let's say, this is the beginning, the theological fundament and basis for the liberation theologies in Latin America. And then people began to realize that they were slaves of structures. Yesterday, I assisted the first conference about the suffering, a theology of suffering. And I defined suffering as being a tremendous expenditure of energy. Have you ever imagined that The populations, the poor populations, let's say of Bolivia, of the slums in Brazil. We have in Brazil 120 million people. Of these 120 million people, only 40 million people participate in the consuming, in the market, in the economic market. 80 million people, two-thirds of the population, they just live, you know, they live. And you can say that about 30 million people live, they work for their daily bread. Have you ever imagined? But in, we cannot imagine this. What it means of energy that you waste away daily and daily with the entity, with the preoccupation. What am I going to eat? What am I going to give to my children? This is something that you have to have been there in such a country to understand. And this is then, let's say, the liberation forces that these people do not want to go ahead as they were up to this point. These peoples want to have, want to be educated. You see, for instance, in Nicaragua, which is a very burning point at this moment, the Sandinista government, however its many defects and mistakes, the first thing, although they had a big flood last year, although they had all this armed thing with Honduras and with America and so forth, they managed to put through since 1979 a literacy campaign, helped by Cuban teachers. These are things that are, this is people, you cannot go, nobody can go against that. And this has its basis in the Bible, in the covenant. Now you see, when you go in the covenant, you understand why nowadays people are beginning to be ecologically minded. We didn't care about that many years ago. But this is, let's say, we are at the end of Bacon and Descartes. We are at the beginning of a new era where to know is to have power means to know is to transmit knowledge to others. And that we are no longer the owners and lords of nature, but that we be again stewards of God's creation. This is a new era. And this will be, let us say, a new beginning, especially for Latin American countries. We are going, all of us, sooner or later, to get rid of the structures of domination, which are enslaving us so long. I just wanted to tell you something. Last year, for instance, 1982, the year theme of our church was Psalm 24:1, land belongs to the Lord, to God, and all that is in it, including the inhabitants. And as a consequence of this, the government got very mad because the government is always tied in with the dominating classes and with the land, big landowners. And there were many clashes because we are having perhaps the country in the world with the largest internal migration. That in the south, the land is becoming too expensive and big farmers are buying up the land and then the small farmers go more to the north. Then they come there and there are big tracts of land, unoccupied. And the owners paying just some dollars a year for taxes. And then they start planting on this land. Two or three years later, the owner sends some paid killers there. And then you have clashes. A pastor of our church was taken in prison, accused of being one of the responsibles for such a clash. He was 100 miles away from the place. And he is a participant of the non-violence movement within our church and together with the Catholic Church. This awakening of the Catholic Church has a tremendous importance for the liberation of Latin America. You all have heard about the basic ecclesiological communities. The Catholic Church is no longer leaving these people, let's say, in the slums, just living, and when they come, they, you know how it was in former days, when a poor man came to the priest and said, you know, I don't have food for my children, this, oh, you know, you are blessed because the Lord said, not only of bread does man live, but also of the word of the Lord, so you will go to heaven directly. Nowadays, we understand and we teach in all churches, excluding some Pentecostal churches, and excluding some churches that you are exporting to Latin America, and that our governments are just importing with a great gusto. We all now teach that when the Lord said, when Jesus said, not only of bread does man live, but of the word of God also, he meant not only of bread, but man had already bread. And you can look in the scriptures, Jesus never spoke to a hungry man. Then out of these, we have wonderful basic communities in Brazil going on, Catholic Church, our own church, working with the very, very poor people. People who are come from the field, you know, who sold their small land tracts, come to the big cities. They have nobody. They don't know anything. They are lost in the big cities. And then we help them. We make associations. But let them decide what they wanted first. And then we only indicate which are the channels that they have to go. But they have to do it themselves in order that they, you know, that they participate. It is not just a giving, giving, giving and be quiet. No, we want them to flower, to participate, to grow internally. It is one of the most wonderful things when such a person, complete outcasts, quite untouchables, as in India one could say, when they say, all of a sudden they realize that they have dignity. You know, when they go the first time to a doctor in one of these communities, sometimes a shed, a very simple shed, they're taught how to wash. They're given soap and taught how to wash themselves. And they say, somos gente, we are people. This means that they didn't consider themselves, they considered themselves, as was here, you see, nature people who, in the opinion of European or European ethnocentrism, are matter and not spirit. And a lot of things got loose with this liberation movement. Our church was the first in Latin America to ordain women. You might think, oh, what, 6, 7 women pastors, this doesn't matter. We are in Brazil, perhaps I think we have in Brazil some 20 women pastors in all of Brazil. This is nothing. It is a symbol. It is always a symbol, and a very important symbol of the liberation also of women. There comes a question now for you people to answer me, or a question that I put to you. You have in the United States been able to build up a society of high ethical content. And I'm the first one to admire it. I have never seen in any other country that a president had to renounce because he lied to the people. This means you have ethical standards. Now comes the question. How come that such a country, whenever you have a problem overseas, be it continental China, be it Vietnam, be it Nicaragua, be it El Salvador, be it Cuba, be it anywhere, why come that you have always as allies the most corrupt part of the elitists? Why come that you have as allies always people, persons, authorities, those components of the elite who have quite all their money deposited in American or Swiss banks? This is a question I put to you. I ask myself, you in the United States, you are in a permanent revolution. You have a democratic system. Every 4 years you make a revolution. And sometimes you make it real. You do not even re-elect the president, which was, you didn't re-elect Carter, which was quite a, you know, everybody knew that the president gets re-elected. You didn't do it, this was good. I didn't like the successor, but this is a personal point of view. I think the fact is wonderful. And you did it. How come, why do you sustain eroded, corrupted, unpopular governments in our part of the world?
when we are now trying to liberate ourselves. You see, for instance, last year I went to Cuba. I was sure. I read the best newspaper in Brazil. I have the best best weekly news magazine, and many quotations from the American press, especially Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Chicago Tribune. Many articles of these newspapers. I was pretty sure that coming to Cuba, I would go into very secluded churches, very closed churches. No, the churches are open. I preached in churches in Cuba. I was surprised. One of these days, I told a brother of ours here this, and he said, "Cannot be. Churches in Cuba must be closed." I said, "No, they are not." Well, we Latin Americans, in spite of all that, in our document last year in Mexico, we put it that in spite of all this suffering, we have a great joy of life. And this you can see in the music in Latin America, especially in Brazil. These poor people, they have joy. They have faith. Faith that you sometimes do not find in developed societies. Faith as it is defined in the Bible, something that you do not see and that you do not know what is going to come. I think the basis again we have in the Bible, Romans 8:28. In my Bible, I hear, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to God's purpose." I think this is more or less what I wanted to say. I'm open to questions, please. We still have 13 minutes.
How did the people of Latin American countries come so easily converted to Christianity when the church that was coming over was associated with a repressive landowner class, a Spanish government that was repressing them? I don't understand how can they turn so readily to Catholicism.
Wonderful. Very easy to explain. There comes a landowner who has soldiers, and he tells, and then comes the priest and tells to the landowner, "You have to convert all these people, have to be baptized." And then the landowner simply says, "Next Sunday everybody is here and you are going to be baptized." That's the way the Negroes were baptized in Brazil.
So are the people real Christians or only nominal Christians? Do they attend Mass or is it just...
They attend Mass, and so over the centuries they became very good Christians. Over the centuries. Because this is a thing that, it didn't happen. It happened, the baptism happened from one day to the other. But then the evolution of this takes centuries. There is a very small and very good church in Bolivia. It's the Methodist Church. And they have only native people. You know what they did? They had American bishops and all that, because this is something that you do export very well, all the structure of the churches, you know. This I sense in Cuba so very well, that these were not the Cuban Methodist Church. The Methodist Church in Cuba was not a Methodist Church in Cuba, it was an American Methodist Church in Cuba. The same with the Lutheran Church. By the way, the Lutheran Missouri, they just fled the country, and the church is now a supermarket, because there in Cuba they say, if you stay in your house, it's yours, private property. But if you flee the country, the government takes it over. The same with churches. And so what did the Bolivian Methodists do? They sent some of their best pastors to Brazil to study in the Methodist seminary in Piracicaba. They came back, and when they had a bunch of bishops, of young pastors, they just threw all foreign bishops out. Now they have a Bolivian, real Bolivian, a Methodist church in Bolivia, a very good church. I don't know if this answers your question, but that's how it happened. And in Brazil, due to that also, we have such a large Afro-Brazilian cults, religious cults, because these were syncretic cults. You know, those slaves, they adored, or they had their deities and they adored them and so forth, and then they were forced to baptize, and the landlord said, "No longer I want anything of your gods." So they just put, instead of having Xangô, they put here Saint George. That's it. One third of Brazilians belong to that. Nominally Catholics and Protestants, but actually, they're not, they go from one to the other. Another question, please.
I'm wondering what kind of self-rule do you envision for the countries in South America, in those countries whose governments are under the influence of the American government, in view of the fact that their tradition has been militaristic, authoritarian government?
This is going to take generations. It is not being done overnight. And sometimes I think that the United States does not understand this. Like, for instance, you see, for instance, now American administration is insisting upon elections in El Salvador. Elections in our countries many times are decided by the money you give to the voter. Especially in the very poor classes. Because in Brazil, you can vote only if you are literate. But literate means that you can sign your name. Not write your name.
Draw
your name. When you draw your name before the judge, the electoral judge, you get a title to vote. And then many times you don't understand the issues. You go with the guy who pays you more. This takes education. This is not, it's not possible to be done through dictatorships. We will have, all of us, periods of readaptation as we are having in Brazil. I think all the other countries will have this. Brazil and Argentina are leading in that, this transition between a very closed military dictatorship with censorship and torture and all that and disappeared persons, to a more open society, although still we are very much controlled by what is called the national security law, which means the military in government. This is going to take its time. It will take time, but the only way to educate us democratically, and this I always say publicly in Brazil, is let's have elections. We do it wrong, next time we'll correct. It's the only way, it's the only way.
What about the underlying educational structure then? What do you envision happening to supply the needed education?
These ecclesiastical, these basic communities of the churches, they start with a classroom. Mm-hmm. A classroom in the small room where a doctor, a physician attends. This is usually the starting of these communities. Then they grow bigger, and then they have even some very big ones already. They have already classes to professionalize people. Let's say those people who come from the interior, from the rural areas, don't know to do anything. They don't know anything. And some, and then they take classes to become a carpenter or a mason or, you know, these professions that we need so much in the cities. So this also is, you know, and we owe very much of this to Vatican II. That really enlightened and opened up the Catholic Church. Many times we are in let's say we are in together and so forth, and people ask us, they ask me in Denmark, why is the liberation theology not the Protestant theology? I said, for goodness sake, thanks God it's Catholic. Imagine a Protestant theology in Latin America. 3%, 4% of the population. Wouldn't do. Okay.
Do you not have the problem then of educating people and then finding they become doctors and that, and then finding they just leave the country and go to America and Canada where they can get paid much better?
We have this exporting of grain is something common to all underdeveloped countries. Mm-hmm. And this has historical roots. In Brazil we didn't have college till 1816, when the college was founded, because Napoleon invaded in 1805. He invaded Spain and Portugal, and then the Portuguese king escaped to Brazil, and then he was there with his cart and everything, so they put up colleges. But the first university was 1912 in our state, and the second, the University of Brazil, was formed together with several colleges in 1919, because the King Albert of Belgium wanted to visit Brazil, and he's asked to visit the university, and we didn't have a university to go. But then, the sons of the landowners, of the landed class, they were sent first to Lisbon, and later on to Paris, and had their good life there. And many of them didn't come back. Now, also we have a lot of export of good brains due to political repression.
Can I share this? This is a journey through the New Nicaragua. I found this in the bookstore up here. And it was published in 1982. And Nicaragua is the only country, I think, in Central America that is not experiencing the kind of revolution that El Salvador is and so on.
Oh, they had much bloodletting.
Yes, but now in here, the people are taking over, the peasants are taking over. And the first thing they build is a school. And the first thing they do, 10 people will send one to school with his promise that he will come back and teach. People that are working full-time in their jobs will still spend 12 hours a week going to school. The women, the children, everyone, they want an education so badly that that is their is primary. And if the land has been unoccupied by a landowner and nothing done to it, they take it over. And they plant it, and the government says, it's yours.
Yes.
And it's,
that's right.
This is very revealing.
I want to tell you about school something that I'm recalling now. My father, when he was a kid, I was born in Ixhuí, a small town interior of Riganzul. Then when my grandfather came to that region in 1889, when this was pure wilderness. And so they cut the first trees and put up, and then they had the seat of the county. But he had his house, his small land, his small farm, you could say. He had 10 miles from the county seat. Well, and then, the kids were born, and they, 5-6 years old, you have to build a school. Then they built a small, my father showed me this when I was a boy of 8 or 9. I can still see it. It was something of 5 meters. Some 15, 16 feet. Yeah, just a rural, small thing. Well, and then all these immigrants, they got together. My grandfather had a great easiness with languages, so he translated to everybody, and they came to Ixhuí, to the mayor, and said, we built a school, please give us a teacher. And he said, you people are crazy. What you want is school. We don't have teachers, nobody knows here really Portuguese, we don't have teachers. You get the least, this is the phrase you use, you get the least dump among you in having as a teacher. Mm. Yeah. Now what did we learn? German. This is historic. We learned German, but this was the idea of education. It is changing now, but we in Brazil have. We have 25 million people who cannot even draw their names. 25. There's been done a lot of effort, Ruth, if you're calling that. We have in Brazil a thing called, I think it's the largest movement of literacy in the world. It's called MOBRAL, Movimento Brasileiro de Alfabetização, a Brazilian movement for alphabetization, for literacy. Unfortunately, they are not using Paulo Freire's method, which is the best and the best proof in the world, because Paulo Freire has leftist ideas. And then when the military took over in 1964, one of the first persons they expelled was Paulo Freire, who has done a marvelous job in India, and he was a consultant to the World Council of Churches and all that, but for Brazil it's not good, Not for Brazil.
Is there no public education in Brazil?
Oh yes, we have. We have a very large system. Yes, we have primary school, secondary school, high school,
kindergarten.
From kindergarten on, public system.
It's all publicly funded.
Publicly funded. Public. No, it's public. The teachers are all federal or state employees,
right.
State or county employees. It's public, but it's not sufficient. So you have private schools. They're very expensive. But when you get to the university, then it happens that you have the entrance exam. Then you have to take special intensive courses, which are very expensive. And what happens then is that the richer, the sons and daughters of richer families, they can take these courses and get into the federal universities, which are free. And of the poorer class, they cannot take these courses, then they will get in the private-owned universities in which they have to pay. Very unfair. Because it's not enough. It should be the whole, we in Brazil are striving to have a whole public education system, wholly public. Well, thank you so much.